It's hard to imagine that one of our greatest minds, Albert Einstein, just might have gone on to even bigger discoveries than he's already famous for. His work in theoretical physics, of course, was widely recognised and celebrated prior to 1919, and he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1921. And until that point in time, Isaac Newton's theories had pretty much dominated all scientific thought for the last two centuries. After his award, Einstein continued to work but became increasingly distant and finally estranged from the next upcoming generation of scientists and their work in quantum mechanics, to the point where it seems he was professionally isolated in his later years. David Badanis joins me from our London studio. He's the author of E equals MC squared, a biography of the world's most famous equation. And his latest is called Einstein's Greatest Mistake, The Life of a Flawed Genius. And he argues that Einstein's confidence in his own powers of intuition proved to be both his greatest strength and, in a sense, his ultimate undoing. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
You think that Einstein might have gone on to make even greater contributions had he opened opened his mind to quantum mechanics as urged by his friend Niels Bohr in Copenhagen?
When Einstein was young, he actually helped create the entire field of quantum mechanics, the study of the ultra-small. That was one of the things that he helped get the Nobel Prize for, not just relativity. And Niels Bohr was about the same age as Einstein. So when Einstein faded out, it wasn't that his brain had faded. In fact, even in retirement in Princeton, he occasionally came up with great ideas trying to refute quantum mechanics. And they were fabulous ideas. At one point, he said, if quantum mechanics is true, we should have something called quantum entanglement. How preposterous is that? And lo and behold, today in the 21st century, we're making computers out of quantum entanglement. So Niels Bohr in his 50s and 60s and even into his 70s had bright young graduate students work with him, was really on the cutting edge of science. And Einstein's mind was still absolutely sharp, but he refused to connect.
He wrote to a colleague in 1938, "I began with a skeptical empiricism, but the problem of gravitation converted me into someone who searches for the inky, reliable source of truth in mathematical simplicity." And that, of course, is one of the great aspects of this character, with these incredibly elegant, simple, astonishing equations.
Well, you hit it on the head when he said confidence. Imagine if somebody can create the most moving symphony you could ever imagine with, say, just two notes, and two notes make it perfect. I know Chopin did some nice stuff where just two notes. Or you could make a computer that worked incredibly well, and you look behind it, you open up, and the circuit board isn't incredibly complicated, but just has a few very simple symmetrical forms. Einstein was like that when he was younger. In his mid-20s, he did good work, E equals MC squared. And in his mid-30s, he did great work. He found an equation that describes the entire universe, space and time and gravity and all that stuff, just in two beautifully symmetric, simple forms. And he thought, ooh, that's really amazing. That's got to be almost a sign of a divine intervention that I was lucky enough to see it.
I'm glad you raised the divinity notion because, of course, fellow atheists claim Einstein as one of theirs, and the religious often point to his use of the word God. I've always seen it as metaphoric rather than theological. What's your position on that?
The best way to find out is to look at Mr. Einstein himself. And when he wrote about it, he explained his position as the following. He wrote several times that he felt sorry for atheists. They were so certain about something that they couldn't know about. So he didn't like that, and he sometimes suggested that they were sort of idolizing themselves. So that's one extreme. So he was against atheism. On the other hand, he didn't believe in the details of any interventionist religion. So he didn't believe in that if there was somebody like Moses, he didn't believe that Moses got divine tablets on Mount Sinai, and if there was a Hebrew man named Joshua in Hebrew in Galilee, he didn't believe that there was a resurrection and things like that. So, but in between, there's a large intermediate ground. His favorite philosopher is probably Spinoza, the sort of pantheistic Jewish philosopher of 17th century. That was sort of Einstein's view. He once described himself as saying, he said he felt like a little boy in a large library in a darkened room. It's kind of misty, and you go in, and the walls are lined with books, this one room lined with books, and those books have all the truths of the universe. And you know they have to have something, because the universe has this subtle, profound structure and shape. And humans usually can't access the books, but occasionally one of our greatest minds is able to lean forward and step forward, take out one of the books and look on it. And in the pages, just briefly open to view, you see those hidden truths that reveal the patterns, which we only get glimpses of. Equals MC squared, that equation might be there. The later stuff that Einstein did in his mid-30s might also be there. And then sadly, we have to close the book and put it back on the shelves. But it really is there. So those were Einstein. Oh, go ahead.
We're all familiar with, the whole world's familiar, because it's been reduced to a graphic on a T-shirt about EB equaling MC squared. But I want you to tell us a little about G equals T.
Right. Everybody knows E equals MC squared. Do you know what it reminds me of? It's sort of like an actor who's known for like a really good comedy role when they're young. And then later they play, they play Lear or something, and they do it incredibly well, and nobody hears of it. So equals MC squared was good, and Einstein came up with that in his mid-20s. It was a way of linking mass and energy, saying energy can turn into mass if you take bright light and shine it really hard at itself. A little bit of solid matter will drip out, and if you take matter, you can explode it apart into energy, like horribly in the atomic bomb. But in 1915, when he was in his mid-30s, and that's what I talk about in Einstein's Greatest Mistake, it's more of the focus, he went further. And he found that if you look at what seems to be empty space, there's a nice way of describing what he came up with in 1915. Imagine that empty space is like just a flat rubber sheet, just like a bed sheet, or a trampoline sheet and stuff. And if everything's totally empty and you just flick a little ball bearing along, it'll go in a straight line. But if you put a heavy rock somewhere on that taut sheet or on a trampoline, it'll sort of sag down in the middle. And then if you flick a little ball bearing along, it'll kind of whip around it, like on a billiard table and stuff, going around the corner and stuff. And he said, well, where we exist in space and where we exist, that the geometry around us is bent down by the things in space. So heavy things, which you can symbolize as T, just bend the geometry around us. And wherever there's bent geometry, you can work out that there's a heavy thing there. So G equals T or T equals G.
And yet, moments later, virtually, he has to reconsider the simplicity and purity of that equation. He loses some of his famous confidence.
Well, that's it. He came up with this in 1915. It was a wonderful achievement. Two simple letters can explain a vast amount of the universe. Then he started exploring it, and he realized that, among other things, that predicts that the universe is expanding. Well, back then, during the First World War, everybody was convinced the universe wasn't expanding, that stars just kind of sit there and we have one galaxy and it sits there and doesn't really move much, just sort of hovering in place, kind of like me getting scared to get up on a surfboard or something like that, barely moving and just twitching. So he said, are you certain? He asked astronomers, and they said, yes, absolutely certain. All the experimental evidence shows that the universe is static. He said, okay, big sigh. And he had to change his equation. He had to put in a whole bunch of other terms to sort of cancel out the expansion to make the static universe.
But he did have a not so much a eureka moment as an I told you so, because later he goes back to the original.
Exactly, because 10 years later, the astronomer said, oops, they had a wonderful oops moment. They said, Einstein, we were wrong. You were right. The universe really is expanding. And Einstein said, exactly what you said, sir. Einstein said, I should have stuck to my original thing. I should have stuck to this vision I had, this clear clarity and simplicity, which is how I thought God or whatever divine force there was had set up the universe. I was totally wrong to listen to the experimentalists, not because experimentalists are always wrong, but because occasionally they're wrong. All the astronomers in the world had had one view in 1915, a different view by 1930. So Einstein drew from that. So he corrected his equation. But for me, that fix, that mistake and that correction, that's not a giant mistake. Anybody could do that. But then he made a psychological mistake, and that's what I talk about in the book. For me, Einstein's greatest mistake was this psychological thing. Like, I suppose what today we'd call it doubling down. I was burned once before. I'm never going to be burned again. The next time I come up with something where I think I have a clear intuition about a simplicity that God laid out in the universe, I'm going to stick to it. If experimentalists say they're finding other results, I'll say, well, you know, temporarily you might be right, but honestly, if you look closer, you'll find that simplicity is what you'll find.
It's, of course, been found that Einstein was not only right all along, but he was probably even righter than he himself understood, because now we know that the universe is not only expanding outwards, but something is propelling it apart at an even faster rate.
Isn't that extraordinary? It would be like if you toss an apple up in the air, instead of it going up at a certain rate and then coming down, it goes up and then voom, you know, it's like it just shoots off and accelerates more. I think one of the most exciting things about modern physics, it'd be lovely if Einstein could still be alive, you know, looking down and seeing this, is how much new stuff has been discovered. This notion from the medieval mystics, they were on the edge of immensities, that the universe is expanding extremely fast and is accelerating all the time. We don't know where that push comes from. That all the matter we see around us, mountains and prime ministers and oceans and galaxies and stuff, that's only a tiny little bit of floating rubble on the surface of something deeper that we don't quite know. And this famous dark matter. And none of that was known of, a little bit of that was known of in Einstein's time. And it's an exciting time now.
You've mentioned dark matter. We've done a few programs on it. How does that factor in to Einstein's thinking? Is it a part of the thought process?
At the time when Einstein was working, it wasn't part of his ideas, because he assumed, as everybody else did, that matter, mass, heavy stuff, would be things that we see around us. It would be things like atoms and molecules and mountains and stuff like that. A real understanding of dark matter only came later. And this is it was noticed when people looked at different distant galaxies and saw that they were moving at ways which suggested there was something stodgy and something heavy in them, which was utterly different from the stars and the planets that might be there. What's exciting is to realize that this might be all around us right now. The only analogy I can think of is how weird this is, or perhaps how liberating. If you go back 200 years and you said that somebody in London could whisper into a rock and somebody in Australia would be able to hear it instantly, you would think, this person is insane. But lo and behold, that's what we do with our mobile phones. Every time you phone somebody far away, phones inside have rocks, silicon, and you know, little bits of metal and little bits of sand and stuff configured in a certain way. And yet they're able to send out these invisible waves that travel through the atmosphere and up into space. They cross a whole planet. This is really extraordinary.
You credit him with, in effect, laying out the basic dynamics of what would become the laser, which was, of course, the basis of today's fiber optic technology, and hence the internet.
Yeah, he was so good. I mean, that's why it was such a shame that he willfully cut himself off. He was so good that after he came up with these great ideas of general relativity in the middle of war-torn Berlin in World War I, almost relaxing a bit over a year later, he started playing around with some ideas. What happened if atoms get energized by some light hitting them? What sort of light will they send out afterwards, and how will that reverberate, so to say, with other atoms? And he came up with what's the theoretical basis for the laser. Nobody, of course, was able to build it in Berlin in 1916. I think it was only about 40 years later that humans began to build it, and our internet and stuff is, what, 10, 20 years old. But he came up with that first 100 years ago. The man was really spectacular.
The last time we were dealing with issues in this orbit of yours was when I was talking to an old friend of the program, Michael Frayn, about his play, Copenhagen, which, as you know, has Heisenberg and an extraordinary interaction with Niels Bohr. And you tell me that, in a sense, Heisenberg's work on uncertainty and the birth of the new quantum mechanics really alienated Einstein, that in a sense he was Einstein's nemesis.
Correct. Heisenberg had a traumatic experience when he was at university. He was a really, really bright boy, and he almost failed his PhD orals because he couldn't work out how well an ordinary microscope magnifies things. He felt humiliated from that. He was a very, very proud man. So a few years later, in his mid and late 20s, I think it was around 1927, he came up with this notion of the famous uncertainty principle, that if you look at a, you know, like when you try to take air from a tire and measure the air pressure, you're kind of disturbing it just by taking the air out. And Heisenberg, in a similar way, he thought, well, if you have an incredible microscope, you want to look at something, you have to shoot a little bit of light at it. Well, that light will bounce it out of position. So if you can see it, you actually move it and disturb it at the very moment you see it. Developments of that idea became the uncertainty principle. And Heisenberg thought, that's the way the universe is. Einstein said, oh, this is really interesting. This describes what we notice. But of course, with better technology and better machines, we'll be able to perhaps not perturb things in that way, that we'll be able to find some very clear, simple principles that that explain things. And now, Heisenberg said, no.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but Niels Bohr tries to negotiate between the two of them, in effect, but he takes, and he's a great friend of Einstein's, but he takes Heisenberg's side, and this forces Einstein to start to try to refute the ideas very eagerly and earnestly.
Yes. Einstein, of course, is famous for saying, God does not play dice with the universe, and Niels Bohr used to say, Einstein, stop telling God what to do. Anyways, it turns out, exactly as you said, Einstein tried to refute this, and the way he tried to refute this was by building a mechanism which would show that the uncertainty principle didn't apply. Einstein was really good with his hands. When his sons were young, he used to take matchboxes. He didn't have a lot of money. He would take matchboxes, and he would make nice cable cars for them with strings and matchboxes. His father had been an electrical engineer, a contractor. Einstein had worked in a patent office for many years. He liked ingenious developments. And he kept on trying at a conference when Niels Bohr and Heisenberg were there. He kept on trying to come up with devices which would disprove quantum mechanics. And he would come up with them in the afternoon, and Niels Bohr would harangue his friends, his own friends, and try to find a rebuttal. And in the morning, he'd have a rebuttal. Einstein didn't give up until finally one day at this conference in Brussels, I think it was 1931, Einstein came up with a device that he was convinced was the perfect device that would disprove quantum mechanics. And Heisenberg and Niels Bohr that night couldn't find a solution. They couldn't find a rebuttal. Maybe Einstein was right. Maybe uncertainty was just a temporary, tentative, stage. But it turned out that by the morning, Niels Bohr realized what was wrong. The device that Einstein had come up with to disprove uncertainty, if you took into account the theory of relativity, the device didn't work. And Einstein thought, oh, my own ideas are used against me. But he had the good grace to realize that Bohr was right. After that, Einstein gave up. He felt deep in his heart that everything had to be clear and specific in the universe. He couldn't believe that the old one, as he referred to God, had allowed uncertainty to be there on the deepest level, that underneath everything, there must be clarity. After a while, he thought that history would redeem himself, would redeem him.
It's a sad picture you paint of him towards the end, where he's increasingly isolated. On the one hand, everyone genuflects in his presence, but there's a boredom with him, with younger scientists. They see him as irrelevant.
Correct. They were told to stay away from him. In 1933, in the 1930s, when it was not a good time to be Jewish in Germany, many American universities tried to hire him. And the one he went for was the Princeton Institute of Advanced Studies, which is also known as the Princeton Institute for Advanced Salaries. They offered him good money, and he was a very generous fellow. He used a lot of his energy, maybe Mr. Turnbull would think about it, trying to help refugees get into America and get away from persecution in Europe. But he was at Princeton for over 20 years. And exactly as you said, he'd sometimes go to seminars, and if there were people from the ordinary community who would come, or sometimes film stars, whatever, they'd be very excited. There's Einstein! But professional physicists would yawn and look away and just not want to be there. It was also sad because Einstein once said that physicists come in two sorts. They're either tennis players or golfers. By tennis players, he meant people bad ideas back and forth. Wigner and other people said this. And by golfers, it means you're on your own. When Einstein was at his peak, he was a little bit of a golfer, but he really was a tennis player. He'd always have one or two people that he profoundly needed to work out his ideas with. And at Princeton, although he had a few young graduate students to help him, they themselves weren't right in the mainstream. And the people who were really hot, the people who were coming up with researching things which became the transistor and other great ideas, many of them were at Princeton. They would have loved to work with him, but all that involved quantum mechanics, and he refused to connect.
It's interesting that he becomes, well, the most, after Newton, the most famous scientist in history, although I suppose Stephen Hawking might want to contest that these days. But here he is, he's exalted, he's on the highest of pedestals in the public mind. And of course, he's now remembered and revered for a certain amount of his political involvements. The famous letter, for example, warning the president of the possibility of a German A-bomb, Heisenberg having, you know, sort of linked with the Nazis.
Correct. That was just early on in World War II. Leo Szilard, a Hungarian-Jewish physicist, actually wrote the letter, and they found Einstein, and Einstein signed it to try to get Roosevelt's attention. Einstein didn't know Roosevelt well, but he had dinner with him once at in the Oval Office, in the White House. By the way, Roosevelt seemed to have spoken a German with Einstein. Many educated Americans of that generation, it was part of their proper education to speak German and stuff. So that letter helped jumpstart the atomic bomb. Einstein was considered a security risk by the FBI, and he wasn't allowed to work on the atomic bomb. Plus, of course, quantum mechanics is involved, and he didn't really go in for that. So he didn't know the details of it. To make the atomic bomb, there's a lot of practical engineering. And it was only in 1945, after the bomb was used and its use was announced, his secretary, Helen Dukas, woke him up. He was taking a nap on his country home in Long Island. And told him what had happened, and he was horrified. He said, if I had known it'd be used like this, I wouldn't have lifted a finger.
David, was he unhappy at the end?
It's hard to tell. If he genuinely believed that he would be redeemed by future history, then in that sense, he wouldn't be entirely unhappy. One thing that made him sad is that his best friend, when he was young, died just before Einstein did, a few months before. And Einstein wrote to that best friend's family and said, you know what I really admired about your father? He was a good man and he was a wise man. But most of all, he was married to one person for his whole life and made a relationship work, something which I sadly have failed in twice. And I think Einstein was kind of sad that he was friendly with one of his sons, who's professor of hydraulics in Berkeley. Another son was in and out of mental institutions. And he had many, many affairs. He was charismatic. He was friendly. He was attractive. But he hadn't really found lasting love, and that sort of bothered him. And then, of course, when you get old, the people you yourself have loved from childhood and stuff, his beloved sister, this friend from university, they all pass away. And he knew that because of relativity, there's a sense in which, not that they would meet again, he didn't believe in that, but there's a sense because time is so very variable, there were certain perspectives in the galaxy in which his best friend hadn't indeed yet died and his sister hadn't died, but he couldn't access those places.
David, thank you very much for that. David's book, Einstein's Greatest Mistake, published now by Hachette.